Something from the written text, in my opinion.
You've got the written text from the Okay, just to say that presenting, it wasn't a written for whatever reason. They were commenting on a slightly earlier version of the bill, I think before doing the capital of migration, but there are some changes. But I think that we, now, the state law advisors indicated to me that they are going to write to us asking us to kind of automate the motion. That might be problematic if we cannot share time. Because we've got to finalize, if we're going to get to the NCOP, time for the program, we are going to have to finalize this by the end of the year. It is a flag then as a matter of time. So let me flag that issue and we can think about it. But I would urge members, both counseling and written available to all members, and for that matter to the part of the community, from the creation of the we're also got the recommendation, by the way, it's very important from the part of the solution and working on the state of the SCI, and they have an option to remark it all on. So this is a complicated situation, but it's an exciting one that we get about it. So, I'm just making those preparatory remarks. They relate, I think, somewhat to what you're
saying. So, good morning. My name is Alyssa Moore. I'm from Public Finance at the National Treasury, and with me is Wendy Tomlin from our local government relationship at the National Treasury. Thanks for giving us the opportunity. Treasury would like to start by saying that we support the legislation. We find that it will be critical in the current transition towards public transport provision in a more integrated network approach that we have guiding legislation that provides for accountability and ensure that the transition can be managed properly and also be sustainable. However, the concerns that we do have relate at the broader level, firstly to the financial provisions in the bill. Secondly, there are some provisions with regard to constitutional powers and functions that we'd like to raise. And then lastly, some concerns that relate to the transitional provision that is provided. And I will go through these in detail with regard to the different sections. The first concern, and maybe to preface this in a broader sense, we feel that the bill will be enhanced by separating the functions that are assigned to municipalities through Section 156, or that are currently provincial functions, and differentiating those from functions that are inherently, according to the Constitution, municipal functions. And that will help with different processes relating to these functions. It will allow for better coordination between the functions. But it will also empower municipalities if we do treat them differently. The municipal public transport function is a municipal function, and we would like to see the municipality taking responsibility for fair share setting so that they are able to provide within their own financial position the best possible public transport. This does not mean that the national government cannot play or other fields cannot play a role. They are entitled to provide norms and standards, and I think the bill allows for the minister to provide for the best fair structure. We are just calling that those do not become prescriptive as this is a function that already lies at the local level and cannot be made subject to approval from other levels. We would like to maybe recommend, however, that there could be some consultation with the Minister of Finance with regards to the fair setting that could be the first time. The bill in section 51.2 provides an entitlement to a subsidy. Now, the current position is that although there is an agreement that we move towards the public transport subsidy, the engagement of the Treasury and the policy that regards that subsidy setting process has not taken place. And we feel, in light of the policy that the bill actually calls to be written, we would not want to see any entitlements that are created through statute until such time as we understand the policy and that has been approved by Cabinet. Okay, we do have some concerns in terms of the intention of Section 51.3. It allows for consultation. I think the Accountant General and the National Treasury and we would just like the department to give us some detail with regards to what the intention was of providing for negotiations with the Treasury. But I'm not going to dwell on that, maybe the department can just respond to this one. The third issue we'd like to raise is with regards to the liabilities that are created on the state. Firstly, a liability is created through Section 58.2A. So that speaks to the statutory recapitalization process. The policy approved for the taxable recapitalization was a program that would be a 7-year program, but we had a temporary intervention in that industry. And we would like to remove that provision. I know the department actually did try to remove it, but he didn't quite get it out. We would really want to see it go. The state, you know, we don't want to provide legislation that provides for continuous state intervention in a certain industry through legislation. The Section 16.8, it is not a direct liability. It does, however, say that the transport authorities cannot be liquidated. Although there are some work, the Treasury is busy with some work in the Public Finance Management Act to support the closing down the disbandment of public entities. This is not on the table yet. And we're wondering whether we can work with you to find a way in which we stipulate the process for which the minister determines how the assets and the liabilities will be dealt with, even if the bill just provides that the minister should take on the responsibility to decide on that process through which you just establish, in a sense, a transport authority. Chair, then the bill creates three levels of funds for national, provincial, and local government. The National Treasury believes that these funding matters should be dealt with through the Division of Revenue Act, and that similar provisions relating to the withholding of funds in Section 6.5 and Section 35.9 can be removed. They provide for withholding of funds, and these matters are actually a constitutionally determined function, how it should be performed, and we don't believe that the legislation should provide alternatives to the constitutionally provided process. And then, with regards to the earmarking of the fuel levy, although the Minister of Finance in in the budget review 2008 did indicate that the Treasury is putting forward the proposal of a fuel tax. The necessary budget processes and engagement with the budget council, etc., has not taken place, and it is not appropriate for that tax to be mentioned in sector legislation. It will be dealt with through the National Revenue Laws Act, and we are requesting that Section 33 be in therefore removed. Finally, on the financial side, Section 35.8 provides that the Minister of Transport can make regulations after consultation with the Minister of Finance. Since the Municipal Finance Management Act and its regulations remain the responsibility of the Minister of Finance. And we would like, again, for the Department to remove the section providing for regulations done through the Minister of Transport. I think the point we are trying to make is to show that the bill already recognises the function as both management and implementation role, also provides for a financial planning role in Section 20, and allows very specifically for municipalities in 21M to determine and adjust anything. However, it also provides for other spheres of government to have a role, and I think that is where our concern comes into. Although we acknowledge that the Minister has a normative and providing norms and standards role with regards to fair, and we would like our Minister to be consulted, the National Public Transport Regulator also has an oversight and an advisory role. And this is where we are warning that the approval should not, it should not be for approval, it should be to set norms and standards.
Possibly just add to that, the syndicate need to be with section or schedule 40 of the Constitution, which stipulates that public transport is a municipal function.
Municipal transport.
Yeah, municipal transport. Which is not defined yet. Let me need to link it back to the internal processes of the municipality defined in section 160 of the Constitution, which makes it very clear in section 1C2, it says the following functions may not be delegated by a municipal council, and it includes the imposition of rates and other taxes levied and use, which then gives them the right to include that. That means no one else. But what it does allow for is, of course, we include in the Constitution section 158, I think. It does stipulate that national government and British government must ensure the effective functioning of the government, which then gives the right to prescribe what we say norms and standards. And norms and standards intended to assist that the service are provided cost effectively, efficiency, compliance with safety requirements, and the government funds. Then a municipality is not a municipal function, therefore a different regulatory environment. And that's from there we come.
And therefore, then it's my intervention of it. Probably still with the definitely your bottom. So this you know, their role would be in this process, I think, is why the second part is, there is confusion as to who is the first part of this. That's going to be a really important. It's actually the problem that I've got right now. What the part of me is terrifying, who has what responsibility, and then sure it's not your ass. Can we flag this? Because this is very much in the list. I'll come back. If the information that provides that there's a lot of there's an apparent lack of status between the convention of the hospital that we should actually consider. But not much second point.
Yes, Chairman, if I may, I think we're very much on the same page on this one. What they're both trying to do is not to set fares in the case of unsubsidized services, set possibly maximum fares for metered taxis to prevent exploitation. It's only for in the case of subsidized services to empower the municipalities for those that have the function to determine standards for interoperability of fares, to give them the power to do through ticketing and things like that, not actually to set fares. Also, the provisions on tariffs apply to things that the municipalities charge. Here we're talking about fares that private operators charge, but those operators may be subsidized. We've also proposed a change to section 21M. Remember, Sabah also had a problem with it. So we would propose a change there, which I think would be more in line with what the Treasury is talking about.
If there's nearly an indication that the policy guiding the subsidies in the new public transport sector has not been established. And therefore, if you have a look at section 51.2C.
Other reference then. Okay, so you're saying look at this and then look at this.
Yeah.
Relation to
51. Oh, well, I don't know if it's unrelated to see. What it does is it provides for the continued subsidization. So what we're worried about is the reference there after point C to say that any extension of the above must continue to be subsidized. That is the concern that we have at this stage with no understanding of the subsidy or the implications thereof to provide for a legislative right to that subsidy creates some uncomfortableness from our side.
if you read the whole thing, the study group, if after the expiry of any of the negotiated contracts concluded under 15, plus the 9% contract
if I could come in there, so it's typing error in this section. The way it's supposed to read, after clause C, it's supposed to read, or any extension thereof, the relevant services will continue to be subsidized. Delete the end. This must be done in terms. Okay.
Any extension of the relevant
services will, and must become will, continue to be subsidized. Delete the end. This must be done in terms of a subsidized service contract. So what we're saying is, if one of these negotiated contracts comes to an end, or one of the outside contracts, and you still want to subsidize the services, then you must do a subsidized service contract in terms of clause 51. We're not saying anybody's entitled to subsidy. We want to regulate that type of contract.
Contracting authority must set steps to different criteria and which criteria before expiry of contract is compensated in blah 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 to put arrangements in place for the services to put out the tender so that the services can be made. If our expiry involves
we have a number of contracts in place under the existing NRCTO. We have interim contracts, we've got negotiated contracts, we've got current tendered contracts, and so on. So we actually want to say two things, that when those contracts come to an end, they must go out on tender, and if they are still going to be subsidized, then you must do a subsidized service contract under this section. And section 50 allows for and a first round of negotiated contracts to put the integrated network in place. But then we say when that comes to an end, you also go out on tender. If you're still going to subsidize, obviously, if you're going to subsidize, you go out on tender and then you must do a subsidized service contract. But our intention is not to create any impression that there's an entitlement to subsidy.
Is it my office to be just trying to do my the will, the old must now become a my. Then you retain your contract, but you don't see how that requirement on the administrative.
Now, this is a linguistic issue. We're saying if you decide to subsidize, if those services are going to be subsidized, then you must do a type of contract. But we can change the wording. There was a problem with the NLCPA, which required services to put out on tender when the contract came to an end, but instead they were just extended and extended. And this is why we put in 51.3, which the Treasury seems to have a problem with. to say that if this is not done, the minister must then engage with the party and in an effort to make sure that it gets done. And if anyone can suggest a better solution, we would welcome it. But this is an attempt to try and force the process to take place.
One would expect that if you have canned a bill, then there must be a period of extension within which then all things must happen. After which, if things have not yet happened, then there must be a recall on that specific thing. So one was just expecting that if we can build, we see that those relevant
what we're actually saying is that when those contracts end, you must immediately go out and send them. That is your time period. But we said that in the NLTPA and it didn't work. So we could say, okay, within 3 years or something, that's no problem. But I don't know if it was
too
a possible solution would be to require the minister to make regulations on a procedure that must happen, which may then as a minister's intervention as a last resort, but not quite sure what you'd say in the regulations, but you could put out a step-by-step procedure for an intervention instead of involving the minister straight away. That's possible.
I'm just trying to make my contribution here.
Yes.
My understanding from Treasury is that they have this problem, particularly in reference to 8J, where there's no clear policy which would determine some futuristic sort of, you know, projected cost of this particular subsidy, which is the second biggest single item on the department's budget. We've got to actually consider this in light of the fact that, you know, we don't want this infinitum to continue when the current federal system is dogged with corruption. We know. You know, there's a golden arrow story cropping up in my area as well, where these tenders have been sort of corrupt. Now, how do we actually deal with that, Chair? That is what we're trying to say in legislation. That if we're going to do this project, and it's the right process, then we're going to have a clear either policy or termination date as to when one starts and the other one phases in, of which Treasury can actually plan for in terms of funding them into the future. The problem I have at the moment is that possibly with the new public transport initiative taking place in some of the big cities, you might find a conglomerate formation of some sort of organisation coming together, of which the clear way to do it, rather than actually subsidize all these entities as an operator, is to do it through the commuter. Now, you know, I'm wondering whether the department's really looked at this process and see whether that's not what this is, the crux of the problem. We can't carry on with the system. I mean, it's just clearly just draining the financial system. It's not clear.
Okay, but I'll try and help us on the way.
The regulations are not telling you that we simply want to have that session, and I'll propose that it uses may, that it may continue to be subsidized, and then it is made for a particular period, and then making reference under the particular reference to 3, where we'll be indicating that the minister may put the regulation, you know, that is stipulated now, what must happen within that particular field of extension. So that is, the extension is actually on condition that something must happen in accordance with what the minister will have put the regulations on to actually make sure that the new contracts are established.
So can we get something like the working funding like this? So I can't ensure that that's nothing. I'm really building on what Dennis is saying. For any extension thereof, the resident services may continue to be served, and for a limited period, in terms of regulation,
what is the limited period?
If I could just give some perspective on the subsidy issue. The department's policy, and I think Mr. Pillay will agree with me, is to subsidize the passenger, not to operate. And that's the idea that you although a subsidy can be done for other reasons. But in any 12 cities where the integrated networks will be done, there will be a move to a growth-based type of contract. And what some cities are aiming for is that the city will actually buy the infrastructure or put it in place and possibly the buses so that you may not even need operational subsidies. So the East Bay is moving.
Just Wayne.
I think
the key issue is that in terms of, you know, getting to some contract, which is what we're looking for here, is the policy to be cleared by cabinet in some period of time. Now, we've heard that there is this and there is that going on, but it's not common across all provinces, it's not common across all municipalities. And I think I come back to 8J. I think that's the biggest thing. That, you know, if we're going to include the wording policy and principles inside for paying subsidy, that will determine, in a sense, how it's going to be done and for what period or how it will operate into the future. So can we not, in terms of this, try and link the policy and the clearance of that policy with Treasury, Cabinet, yet as it may, as the process way forward, or the, you know, try at least that in place, that irrespective then, in terms of budgeting process, there is something that you can work on as a document for the future.
Maybe in relation to the point that Mr. Farrow's made, we might use the subsidy policy to ensure compliance with this legislation. So instead of providing a negotiating forum with AFMIRS Auditor General, we might say in that policy that should certain sections, and we can be specific or general, not be complied with, that subsidy policy will kick in and
Thank you, Jess. Just some clarity on the policy issue. The policy framework is in place in terms of the national white paper, which basically targets the poor as a result of this and so on. But that has then been extended to look at the network approach in terms of public transport services. That in future, the policy framework would be that the subsidy would be applicable to those networks which have been approved by cabinet. However, we also say that in the larger cities, if you look at the embarking on the network approach, we believe that subsidies after a period of time would scale down as affecting the government. So I don't think there is a policy gap in this. I think it's just an issue of semantics as well. Of what we are sitting with now, which is the interim contract with the ones that we want to move away from, which was based on ticket sales and which is open to fraud in the manner in which it operates, and move towards a kilometer-based contract. Now, the issue of ownership and the point made by Honourable Member Farrell is that the beneficiary should be the commuter. But the manner in which the subsidy is paid and affects the commuter is by the operator.
We're all broadly agreeing with where we want to go, all of that. What we're dealing with here is that we want to help it and trying to get compliant to what we're trying to do. And is there anything wrong with that
popular STC industry that started before the actual contract era. Therefore, the extension cannot be even more than a year or so, although we are not putting card now, but I mean, we don't expect that this kind of extension should be more than a year, because it's an extension to complete what was supposed to be completed.
Provided it's a year, not longer. Any objection? Exactly right. This is like a pullback from a terrible hardship that we're going on.
A lot of the new contracts would require additional funding, and that's the reason why many of the contracts have not been converted into the tender. But I mean, now we that was processes that were started from 1997 onwards. But now we're into a new regime, so we look at a different way of protection.
We're not dealing with that large problem, it's dangerous to
we formulated the charge. It was basically just deleting all the references to the shaping around in that book. In 58.2H, we delete the word basically that hold of the shaping around by the department, delete those words. And then 58.2B2, Roman 2, is deleted. Of Roman 2, yeah, and then 3 becomes 2.
Yeah. Okay.
So the bottom is the extension to 58.2A.
Okay. It will now read to leave the industry, in which case the department must check the vehicle and cancel the permit to operate in that.
The concept of scrapping is only used from the national department perspective in the factory checkup. The only other people who scrap are people. So there might be an implied incentive to say that, you know, when we say as a national department we're going to scrap, that means we're going to value $50,000. I think we must just understand what is the intention of the department in that section. What are we trying to say, and whether it's really necessary before we get ourselves entangled.
Everything that's on the treasury point of view, I'm looking from a policy.
So the problem we have to deal with is converting permits. We have thousands of permits out there that many of them wrongly issued, etc. trying to provide for a conversion site. So we say the operator comes in with his or her permit and has a choice. Either says, okay, here's my vehicle, stop it, here's my permit, and the permit is cancelled. The other choice is he or she gets the scrapping allowance, puts it down as a deposit on a new vehicle, which must be an approved vehicle, and then get an operating license. And we need to add in there that that operating license must be route-based and based on the actual operations for the last 180 days. I think we mentioned it last week, but we proposed that change as well. You know, it's difficult to legislate a conversion process without mentioning that.
Why do we have to enact it in this place? That's the policy of the program. We're just running well enough to subject to another debate and discussion. But when you see the logic, and the logic is explained, in other words, from the trying to grab a lot of policies, but also connected by questions about getting out people, so that's not what we need. But we might, somewhere along the line, decide that. What we're trying to do here is link some planning, link some identity, subsidizing if we need to of public transit, but linking to systems integrated systems rather than. So a policy option is effective. I agree with you that they're worried about potential management. For me, it's one route, but it's not the only one. We need some routes, that's what we're trying to do in the commission. How we do that, how we can find that, doesn't have to be written for all of that. We know that's the program, and it's running as part of it. It's got a bunch of the allegations. And we need to evaluate it.
Whether individual taxis join transport but in small towns that might actually be the wrong direction to come from. And what we mustn't do is over plan ourselves. We must
evolve that plan.
But can we agree which way we've got? We scrap the grass.
This model is a separate legal entity as with the NRCP. We would like to discuss
that. So we can pop over that, but we will not. Creation of new funds and share market fuel debt. And there we're looking at
say you're pretending to go ahead, energetic, comfort focus.
Why should the funds be given to the municipality that is for the good credit rating, and then those that are for no good credit rating then continue to get less money? Instead, you know, it's for people of either sharing the resources or cross-subsidizing that they've got all municipalities going up. I mean, there are a lot of things in municipalities. Johannesburg Metro may have the capacity to even get funding from other people. But when the fund gets used for this, they may not have that capacity. But now, in the view of actually trying to, I can look the way, but I think it's wrong. Cross-subsidizing the resources, like shifting the resources where they may not be that much into the community and the fund because of their. Without actually celebrating their incapacity to raise money. But at the end of the day, as government, we need to make sure that we have got services that need to be better across all the country.
Yeah.
If we build on that point as well, every year when the Division of Revenue Act is determined, we put through a very stringent process when we determine equitable allocation. We need to take into account section 214, D, which says CDCD, we need to ensure that provinces and municipalities are able to provide basic services and form the funds to be allocated to them. We need then to raise again another criteria that's also part of section 214, and that's C, the fiscal capacity and efficiency of provinces and municipalities. So that is actually intended to actually deal with the nominee and different capacities of municipalities. There's some are large in self-finance and other municipalities are much more reliant.
I understand what you said now. The equitable share determines on an annual basis, I assume, or over the medium term, what grants be given to the various sections to get jobs or paid out on the tax. Now, those conditional grants or ring-fenced funding or transport, am I right to believe them are predetermined and therefore they cannot be withheld? Can they be withheld? Because effectively, it does go through a process that I understand. You know, it's either from district to municipality or from province to metro or whatever. Now, we might get a case in question where that could stall the process by virtue of someone jealously guarding funding and not releasing it because of whatever. Politically, you know, you name it. And there are these scenarios that could develop that funding. Now, I don't know whether that is correct, that we should in fact have, you know, a situation arising like that. On the other hand, I don't know, and I'm not being reassured unless they can, that the equitable share of those divisions of revenue that are determined are actually fixed and they cannot. Because if it does go, it must go by law. I'm trying to find out what the real crux of why that clause is in there, for what purpose is there, whether in fact according to the finance or the provision of revenue, those things are conditional and they go there and they should be allocated. And the reason for withholding might be because of bad governance, maybe, or something like that. But, you know, I just want some clarity before I comment.
Okay, I
noticed
in the
requirements
there's
a
provision that says that scratching out. So maybe we don't need to. I think we're trying to be, they're a set of principles, which are, I mean, one is the division of revenue act and all of that, critical shares, which is already there. Okay. Then presumably we need don't need to write this into any statement. Because the kind of thing that is concerned about, not illegitimate, but that would be other issues to be borne in mind, is already counted for, or should be, one within policy, two within the division of the United States. I think that's what you're saying.
No problem.
And am I right in saying that?
Secondly, I think it's important to note that, well, although there's been an announcement that the fuel levy will be shared, or consideration is underway to share the fuel levy between national provincial and other governments, it should also be understood in the right context. If you look at the 2008 budget review, it was actually made quite clear what the sharing is intended. The sharing of the fuel levy first is intended to expand the interim grant for Metro for ONC levy that will have abolished 1 July 2004. And that is one of the key criteria that we're actually striving for. And then the second one is, I'm not sure if you're aware that for the West Impact there was a fuel levy also to a tax, additional tax on top of that. And there's also consideration given that rather than the West Impact introducing the additional that the sharing will be concentrated provinces. What National Treasury is currently underway is through the flexible move amendment legislation. We're currently in the drafting of that, but it will not be for the specific
here is to try to a number of different, but the main business is to take the national policy and find
possibility that it could come into the system. In what you're doing, you're taking a bit of the fuel that you're working on. More we used to.
Also, another helping on the powers and functions. When it's clear what the national department will be doing, it will be clear what will be the budget crisis. That and some of the powers that these are two regulators should be taking up for specific functions and we must deal with them in that way. Creating a fund is not adding any value to the we need to, these discussions need to come from the powers and functions and us, and we should go either on both 53. Through the effort for shares to provinces, all municipalities, and then through some conditional grants. The way we've got it now is through the conditional grants to municipalities that is specific for public transport. These things can be timbered and tinkled on and improved, but it exists. So I think the question is, what are we gaining by having this section? And maybe just on the city's network view that they want to just create a pot and not necessarily fill it. Again, there are mechanisms to do that. We do not need to say this item for a city to say this is ring fence for public transport.
But in short, you come in as it, and you raise it then later under the Constitution. But here, you just, your concerns are triggered by the progressive levy and other things that you're doing. But really, what you're saying is it's not needed.
Making road construction, and you know that has not really been taken things that I think is important, if you take that out, would be to look at another way of trying to do it, which would allow public transport to effectively build up some sort of reserve to be able to operate, and also at the same time to make it easier on them to in fact continue and sustain themselves into the future, for instance, like exemption that the fisheries and agriculture get for fuel. But I don't think we need to specifically say that, you know, we're going to have to take this money from here. But we should actually clearly define that apart from seeking a kind of creative national transport fund to come in support of and to secure funds into some sort of, you know, into the future, that we should maybe look at trying to put a word in there that allows that to happen somehow, that there's some security of, you know, going into the future. But not necessarily the fuel area, because I think if you look at that, and I haven't got the act with me, I'm absolutely certain that that's the road act actually refers to the levies for road maintenance, which doesn't then actually make this paragraph sense in terms of public transport and its function in municipalities. I don't know whether I've got, you know, trying to, maybe there should be something clearly defined there that doesn't necessarily interfere with that, but in another way, somewhere along the line, create an opportunity for funding to be sourced into a private fund, which I'm really supportive of.
Why don't we
put
that
on
The way we have conceived of this fund over here, basically we are looking at it as a form of a dedicated fund and as a form of a conditional grant. So it would have to go through the division of Revenue Act on the one hand. But the way we were looking at it is that in principle we felt that transport investments in themselves are actually, you know, take on in a sense, lumpy investments are required in order to make impact over a period of time. The element connected to that is that you have certain policy prescripts that are emerging, especially the policies that are, and strategies that are emerging post-1996. And in order to give back into those type of policies and strategies, because that was one of the ways through which we can actually link the policy outcomes with the funding arrangement as well, because it's the truth. for instance, I mean, our view is that, if the strategy is saying that we need to roll out ERPs, and that becomes an imperative of national government, then we think that that kind of trimming down in that manner is a better way of actually ensuring that that function is actually delivered, or that service is actually delivered along those lines. As opposed to being used for various other methods.
As I understand, our major objection into that comes via the public transport
infrastructure. That's fine. So that was the intention. So the PTIF fund, for example, would be used to actually protect that delivery in that manner.
What is wrong with PTIF?
It's a fund as well.
Why do we need something different?
Well, the PTIF, I think, has a limited time frame. It's not a permanent feature. But then we can.
There are no permanent features in the budget, but I think there was some confusion. As you indicated earlier, we did focus the PTIF on 2010, but there was no intention to limit the fund. It was a public transport grant. The idea for public transport.
This is not a monopoly, it's not our monopoly, it's Parliament's monopoly on the budget. The department to get this thing rolled out, their role in terms of setting laws and standards and making clear what they want to see. That is how you ensure that municipalities and provinces spend money on what your policies are saying they should.
One of the objectives was, or let's say in the strategy document we interviewed a lot of people, and one of the core problems is lack of sustainable, predictable funding for longer term projects. The way the budgeting process works is every year you look at your priorities and you distribute. And this is always put forward as a reason why transport authorities were not established. Okay, you'll give us X rand in year one, but we have no idea what we'll get in year two. So this was an attempt in that time, and also, you know that once money is there, it's been dedicated for a certain purpose, that this is the thing.
Yeah, no,
I think
not.
This goes on the point made earlier on. Now, we need to look at Section 77 of the Constitution that specifically was money bill. And it states when a bill becomes a money bill, a bill is a money bill if it imposes national taxes, duties, duties, or surcharges. And then it prescribes processes which need to be followed in this bill. This legislation is unfortunately not sufficient for this legislation. And for that reason, it's where a project comes in. As Marissa pointed out earlier on, the issue of the funding of a body and or regulated institutions form certain functions, that must be put to a certain approach. And what then will be done is to look at compliance with certain requirements, what the institution wants to achieve, what the subject money is. And various funding options can be explored. The issue is here that the system is down on paper, and you will see legislation. We cannot deal with certain things. So even if it's retained, if, for example, still really wants to be explored as a further option, there's still other national legislation that will need to be passed to enable this. So if we're still really dealt with most probably the Customs and Excise Act, and there would need to be made amendments there. So the only issue that we're discussing here is that. Let's deal with it on the table and then with the funding mechanism.
described in the legislation, and even in the process, it is incorrect legislation. That's the issue.
Does he recognize there is problems meeting legal policy and the problems of the ELD?
Thanks very much, and good morning to you, Mr.
Thanks for attending a presentation.
No problem.
It seems to me that there are two issues that have been debated. One issue is how do we get a predictable set of fiscal intent to drive the change of the working policy. And the argument which is being made by the National Treasury is that we have a fairly stable system for doing that. And certainly from my experience with municipal infrastructure grants, the impulse is towards integration as opposed to creating fragmentary funding mechanisms. And the way in which you achieve integration is by designing policy around this grant. So if you look at the municipal infrastructure grant, there's a nationally agreed policy framework which is adapted that guides targeting those funds. And the reason you want to do that is because you want to maximize the possibility for local decision-making around the use of those funds within a set of normative considerations. That's the first issue. The second issue, which is there, I sense, but in fact not being articulated, is what you don't want to do in this bill is to pass through unfunded mandates to your local government. It's already a risk that's inherent in the system. And it seems to me that to deal with both of these issues, it comes back to the point that you made in the National Treasury, that it's how you design the system of accountability. Which are the municipal functions, how are we going to define them, and then how do we deal with assignments? And the funding mechanism comes through that network. So as long as policy can ensure that you secure the risk of unfunded mandate, it seems to me that the governmental transfer system may well be the predictable mechanism for dealing with the funding.
Okay.
integrated and democratized. The missing factor here are communities. They're not here.
We've got the flow, we've got tourism industry, that's great. We welcome them here. We've got us.
Yeah, I mean, this is the question, I think, and that's really what we're going to discuss. But I don't know, I'm just been also looking at the submission to you from the Minister of Finance, and there's some really interesting points there, which I quite like in terms of what, you know, we've been trying to get the department to commit themselves to. And that is trying to have some objective criteria relating to funding, or really linked to a current budgetary process, which I understand, you know, is there for subsidization, say, for instance. Could be clearly linked to, you know, the number of commuters or the number of passengers that are actually operating within the current or the system that is proposed in public transport, or the kilometres, you know, that might be considered in terms of the travel that the buses are doing. Now, if we can get that in place, and I think that's, you know, really, because I think we all want to see money going into the right place to promote what we want in the store, but the question is whether we're going to set up these three funds that level and whether this is the right thing, using the fuel levy as one of the sources, but because we really have these programs which I assume will be dedicated towards funding certain processes. But in addition to that, what I think we should be trying to do is to reinforce the process of fund collection which is linked to existing programs like the subsidy scheme for not only buses but also, you know, taxis and so forth. And maybe and you need to just sort of reinforce, I think I picked up when we were talking about those policies, that there really is a policy which links to that process, and maybe we should tie it up as long as it's legitimate, and there can be a train put in place for the purpose of, you know, subsidizing a passenger on a train, a rat, you know, be it on a bus or on a taxi. And that might be the way of ensuring that the flow, which I think we're all concerned about, is going to happen to you. And I don't know whether something we must consider in the school rather than have these three little
different. On the municipal fund, the thinking there was what we don't want to happen is money is collected, let's say levy, traffic calming levy or something. We don't want that going into the big pot and being used for non-transport purposes. So the idea then is to have a fund at that level where the municipality is, has got the functions and then consolidated that, let's put it this way, transport money goes in and gets used for transport purposes. That was the thinking behind that.
Management thing with undermining the very things they're trying to achieve. You might want to spend it on building some resources closer to where people live, contribute to accessibility, and not transport in a narrow community. But we might solve many of our transport problems, not through transport, but through cities that are, where the resources are more easily accessible. People don't have to commute from Dell. So you want cities to be thinking spatially, the built environment, the transport, the housing development, the shopping malls, all of that to be thoughtfully planned. And this is something that's raised by the way. The rest of the comments are like my not to go another road. Maybe it's hard for you to reply to them. So that's why they're thinking about it, because it's a big proposal that we're going to get in mind. That's a huge one. So can we leave it there for the moment? And then I think that we're on municipal finance management and regulation. Sorry, this is what I thought. I know that my colleague from the Blue Star again. We had actually planned to take you first of all, we went quite here, we went short. So are you running into time problems? Mm-hmm. But it's the same what we're doing. Test you guys. And we're not going to last that long. And then come back. We're going to be here with it.
Midnight.
Today on this. Okay,
it's true, we've actually been here from the start.
Yeah.
We do have time constraints, so this month to dedicate from the rail safety regulator and to the bank to get on the
constitutional matters. He has other obligations in Stellenbosch.
What
kind of
city?
As well.
Okay. So we'll then write all the things that you
need to write.
shortly to the ASIC advice that the Minister of Transport can make regulations clarifying the application of the MFMA. The regulations regarding the application of that Act remains with the Executive Authority, with the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Transport cannot make regulations on the MFMA. On the constitutional matters, I think we started off by saying that we have some concerns, but again, just to reiterate, we support the consolidation of the planning, implementation, regulatory and monitoring functions for public transport at the local level. However, we do feel that the Act itself can be more clear, and that should there be a distinction between the assigned and inherent functions, that would assist. We also requesting that in accordance with the section 214 of the Constitution, that this Act will then be subject to provisions regarding the financial and fiscal commission, etc. Any legislation speaking to another level will need to go through this process, and we're hoping that that would also strengthen the bill. The next section is actually quite substantial, but we feel it will really clean up the Act. Yes. If that is a section that provides for impartiality, and it does that in a peculiar way by limiting people's economic engagement. Now, firstly, we consider that might not be pass constitutional muster, and it also clogs up the provision of transport in a sense that I don't think we need. And maybe just be clearer, the impartiality matters, according to the department, is the motivation why municipal type of transport provided by municipalities became not the subsidized. Because if you're going to get out the contract, you won't be partial, and therefore you can't be part of the contract. Now, the Public Finance Management Act in Section 16A provides for impartiality. Provides for people to excuse themselves if they have an interest. We feel that's a much cleaner way to go about it without restricting people's economic activity. I am still allowed to be a public transport provider even if my mother is a VP of transport. So I don't know if the department has any problems with that. You might need to look at it, because I know it's kind of entrenched in the bill as it is, and you might need to go and unplug. But maybe we can move away into a new era.
There's a huge problem out there, traffic officers owning taxis and things like that, isn't it? It's really a big problem. Maybe it's written too broadly, but that's the problem.
Finally, on the constitutional matters, in terms of the determination of capacity, again, that is provided for in the Constitution as a process to decide whether a certain level of government is able to provide a service. And we would like the department to either refer to those sections, but they cannot replace those processes of deciding who are able to provide the different services. And we just make a note that it would be prudent to provide here a dialogues and responsibilities for your smaller municipalities. I think it was raised last week as well. You know, do we see them amalgamating? Obviously, what we're facing now is a constitutional role to municipalities, but that seems that might not have a capacity, and we just want the department to be sensitive to the constitutional processes in terms of how can you determine that capacity and how do you engage it.
Melissa mentioned that section 214 of the Constitution is applicable. Are you saying that because of that fuel levy provision?
No, section 214 indicates that should there be an Act of Parliament that provides for allocation of different tiers of government and in terms of their roles and functions, the act, before it must be enacted, it must go to prevent the government, organize local government, and the current Environment Commission has to be consulted on that. It is basically just a consultation process to ensure that when we clean these balance and functions, it goes through a process to ensure that those involved at the different spheres are engaged with and that they can understand the interface.
Sorry, Chair, I just wanted to add that the Systems Act, in fact, provides the due diligence mechanism for assigning Schedule 4 functions to non-municipal functions to local governments. And to the extent that you're assigning transport functions to provincial functions to local governments, you need to comply with 9 and 10 of the Systems Act. And it speaks to the constitutional provision that Treasury is talking about.
In addition to asking David for David's decision, there's also a source in the SEC Act which needs to be followed.
What? 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 What?
whole competition area and what we're going to do. I think we need to have a, and with the assistance of the central advisors, our colleagues from the ELB, Cross Transport and Treasury, I think we need to put a little bit of time out just to kind of think it through for them. What do we mean by transport authority?
For Fiducia, Fiducia is the Federation of Mayors of South Africa, to present our position with me today outside constituent support. He's also the General Secretary of the SASU, which is one of the oldest unions in the rail industry, and also a member of the Rail Safety Regulator. Very much. So I must say I had a keen interest in your discussion with National Treasury just now because of the Moneyball provision and the USA. In terms of the legislation before you, the National Railway Safety Regulator Amendment Bill, the development of the mandate of the Railway Safety Regulator or specific reference to matters relating to the safety of workers in the railway environment is of paramount importance to our members. Producer and entirely welcome the introduction of this bill because it's a great step towards safety of workers. The Railway Safety Regulator Act 16 of 2002 recognised the intimate relationship between operational safety on the one hand and occupational health and safety on the other hand. And it specifies specifically the role that the Railway Safety Regulator has to perform in terms of this. It must be pointed out that the provisions in the legislation remain very vague. And he does not adequately provide a mandate to the Rail Safety Regulator in terms of matters in the domain of occupational health and safety. And that's still a critical matter, even if the amendment bill does not specifically deal with health and safety issues which have a direct relationship to its primary mandate of exercising oversight and operational safety, which is critical for us. In the rail environment, there's a direct relationship between operational safety and occupational health and safety. A situation which requires a very tight and practical interface between the railway safety inspectorate on the one hand
and the labour inspectors. And our position today will focus a lot on the labour inspectors and the role of safety issues. And we were to these workers. I'm not here to tell you nice things about rail and safety that we're dealing with workers and such. Past experiences that have paid to rail safety. In 2004, we indicated a noise level that the Transnet Freight Rail locomotive with consequences for our members and how it affected their hearing. This is critical. They had the Minister of Labour who conducted an on-site inspection of the TFR locomotives at that stage, and there were specific things that we learned from this in terms of the noise level. And there was an immediate safety limit instruction to rectify the problem. And to this day, for example, it has not been rectified. And how does the railway safety regulator deal with issues such as that? The bill is very silent on that, and also the actions of that. Mr. DeForest will maybe just broaden some of those aspects.
Okay, yes, it's rather embarrassing situation. The Minister of Labour came out in April 2004 with all these inspectors. He went to the shunting yard. He instructed the then CEO until December 2004 to create a safe environment. The previous CEO of the Swernet, now that is referred to as Fraser Rail. December has gone, 2004, we're 4 years later. And you know, our members are blaming us the same when it comes to closing these little Chinese factories. The minister is very quick to close them down. But when it comes to better safety, you know, and especially when it deals with our safety, our member safety, is a rather embarrassing situation. 4 years later, and we haven't finalized this yet.
Section 20 of the National Railway Safety Regulator requires the Railway Safety Regulator to report to Parliament on the safety of workers and the public. It does not accord the railway safety regulator any real power to deal with unsafe conditions at the workplace. These conditions are basically given to the operator to deal with. And I think the railway safety regulator, when we established the railway safety regulator, that's not supposed to be one of the functions that they perform as such. It's our submission that the railway safety regulator must be empowered to utilize instruments at its disposal. The provision of improvement notices to compel operators to comply with legal provisions, irrespective of whether such conduct relates to occupational safety or not. The test in this regard would be whether such conditions may reasonably give rise to an unsafe condition, which will undermine operational safety, as envisaged in the National Railway Safety Regulator Act. It also has admission that the Railway Safety Regulator must be empowered to act on violations of occupational health and safety, and through the established cooperation with the Department of Labour, advise the Labour inspectors for any further action as may be necessary. The new clause 3 in the bill specifically amends section 5 of the Act to clarify that operators remain responsible for railway safety, and that the function of the railway safety regulator is to promote safety. We feel that maybe what we need to do is to come out a lot stronger and a lot harsher than the issues of the railway safety regulator's role in this. The proposal is that similarly section 20 of the National Railway Safety Regulator Act must be broadened to compel the National Railway Safety Regulator to disclose instances where operators pay little or no attention to the safety of workers. There's also a proposal on reporting of incidents. Rail operators have developed a tendency of secrecy when incidents occur on their network. There's actually something that has to be hidden away that's allowing for concerned parties to make their own uninformed judgments, whereby innocent victims are made scapegoat victims in terms of claims. It's our submission that rail operators be required to immediately inform or report all or any incidents to the railway safety regulator to enable the railway safety regulator to be involved in any or all investigations immediately. This should also be done within a very short time frame. We welcome the amendment of Clause 1 of the Act to clarify the responsibilities of such operators, the amendment to stations and the defining of the train operators. We welcome specifically the provision in Clause 1 that a threat to safety can also include behaviour that can develop into an unsafe situation, which is very important. If I look at some of the railway stations, for example, some of the Metro Rail trains in Cape Town, for example, safety checks
in practice, things that need to be in place are not always done, and that's problematic. We're running with old trains where the brakes aren't serviced as it should be done, and we need to deal more with it where situations are created. New clause 15 in the bill specifically to the railway inspectors to investigate matters such as the packaging, marking, and classification of dangerous goods prior to their loading onto the train are welcome. However, in terms of section 32 of the Act, it deals specifically with the appointment of inspectors. Now, not enough inspectors are appointed, and that's one of the problems. It's a similar problem that we have with aviation safety in terms of inspectors there. Now, we need inspectors on the ground in order to do the inspection. If we do not have inspectors, then there's nobody that can look at your health and safety issues. Not enough inspectors are appointed, and the whole issue pertains to funding. We do not have enough money to pay for inspectors are coming up. Inspections are critical aspects of safety. It's more dangerous for staff and regular commuters and members to wonder how a safe and efficient transport system for World Cup 2010 will come about. The ideal of a public rail system is one where railway professionals pull together to achieve safe, efficient, reliable and economic transport services. Transport site rail and metro rail measure very poorly against the CRC. There's no sufficient management or working team work issues on rail in the company. More equipment is substandard. Training levels have declined and safety standards on the brink of criminal networks. Although Transnet and operating divisions regularly issue safety statements as the one that they did yesterday in a document where it was clearly indicated the culture charter launch by Maria Ram, it was clearly indicated safety is a critical issue and that they will work with labour specifically on some of these safety issues. It's critical. It's noticeable when things go wrong. It's always someone at the operating level who's made neither the system, who's giving you substandard equipment, or someone that's worked to the point of exhaustion, or has tried poorly qualified workers into positions of responsibility beyond their training and experience. And this is very, very problematic. The situation of a technical workers remains critical. Early in 2002, after a train disaster, Utatu published the causes of accidents, and this remains Optulus, unsafe, unhygienic, trains, Optulus rolling stock, Optulus and inefficient signaling systems, inadequate protection of railway lines and property, exploitation of key operational employees to the point where they are chronically fatigued and unable to perform their jobs with optimum efficiency, overdue application of transformation, the splashing company agendas ahead of community safety, managerial cover-up to compel employees to bear the consequences of operational shortcomings. A real safety concern involves the transport of explosives, though in clause 16 of the bill is welcome, because this deals specifically when occurrences happen done in an open and investigative manner where lessons are learned. We need to, greater power also needs to be given to the railway safety regulator to deal specifically with this issue. Protection measures to protect witnesses appearing before the board should also be developed. And this brings us to the critical aspect of the whistleblower protection. Now, as the railway networks of Africa say, the major role in the development of the economy in the country is a lot. It's paramount importance that all unsafe conditions or working conditions be eradicated at all costs. If someone needs to bring an issue pertaining to health and safety to the attention of the railway safety regulator, whoever becomes aware thereof, it must be done without the fear of being victimized. Now, victimization and the fear of bringing about these issues is a daily occurrence. You're too afraid of your boss to bring out the concerns pertaining to the safety issues. It's our submission that a whistleblower protection mechanism be put into place by the railway safety regulator to protect employees of the rail operator who bring to attention any unsafe conditions or working conditions. We can bring a couple of hundreds of train drivers and metro employees and rail operator employees here to come and speak about safety issues, but they're afraid to do that. And we need some whistleblowing protection in terms of that. And the provision of the current whistleblowing act, the National Act, can be utilized for that. The promotion of justice as closing remarks,
would like to thank the portfolio committee for allowing us this opportunity to address our comments pertaining to the National Railway Safety Regulator Amendment Bill, and we would be available for questions because safety of commuters and safety of the very people that work within the railway system is very important.
Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for the Now, some of the issues which you're correctly raising obviously go a little bit beyond the scope of what we can do by way of an amendment bill, which is not to say we answer the debt and welcome the issues that we're raising. So, obviously, for the purpose of today, of now, so, let's focus on looking at how we might improve.
There is a known fact which exists. I think it came out of the Professor LaRue lecture, which indicated clearly some of the implications involved in the cab drivers, interest as passengers smoke, there was even reports of Dachau being, going through the door, and, whistle, call, whatever, as a result of the noise in the cab. There is a process now where an occurrence could occur where that driver now could be upheld in terms of a certain fault or fault. And, you know, it could then go back and end up, you know, as a direct result of the fact that it's work-related. Now, what happens there? Does it then get handed over to the Department of Labor to deal with it? Or does it form part of this particular code for inquiry investigation, for if you like, with the rail safety regulatory practice undertaking? I just don't know, you know, whether we can't have a link
with that. Instrumental things in the workplace should work, should not be addressed, and not be addressed whatever the work environment might be, like a rail, might be a factory, a mine, or whatever. And that, and we must take those very seriously, and those must be addressed by the person, the labour, and the staff, and legislation under that fall under that law. However, it all depends on that's where we come in and interrupt it. But let me ask, first of all, whether one, you are in agreement that we are not dealing with sufficient current legislation, your theory, where you get an integrated occupational health and safety and general awareness of operational safety. Do you think there's sufficiency of power, or we need to run more?
I'm not sure if it's an easy just a yes or a no answer to that question, whether writing more into that legislation will necessarily address the concern. I think we, I can say unambiguously from a regulator's perspective, share the concern that Labour has as well. But what we recognise that as well. And in the amendments to the regulation and the standards that apply to the reporting of occurrences that we are currently working on, we amplify the whole category of reporting, the timing of reporting, the nature of reporting, and we brought in categories relating to the human being, the human factors, to the point which I've got the document in front of me. I must read just from the one clause, see if it's allowed to come into legislation or whether we will be comfortable with this when it stands. And we call these elements the physical and environmental factors. Our stress is that the impact on the human physiological and psychological equilibrium and impact on railway safety. We're not just looking at somebody losing their hearing, they're losing their hearing, and as such, then there's the potential for an unsafe situation, regardless if he has radio, he doesn't have whatever. And what we're saying then is noise, any sound that can have a distracting effect and impact on railway safety. Vibration, the same thing. Lighting, temperature, and toxic substances. So we've now put those in as new proposals in strong standards that we are working on to raise that to the level so that when our inspectors go out, this becomes part of what there will be an auditing process to look at those things, not just looking at loss of hearing, but looking at the impact of that potential on an unsafe situation. We are really conscious and aware of stepping on the jurisdiction of another body, like the Department of Labor. We have an MOU with them. Unfortunately, the Department of Labor, I presume I can say to you now, they have not come to the party as we would have expected them to. To play the game that we wanted them to do so we could just take hands and decide where the limit of our jurisdiction is and where theirs would be. That has not happened as we envisaged it.
What are you looking for?
We have an MOU with them to say that we recognize areas that we have common, that are right, common jurisdiction, potentially overlapping jurisdiction. And as such, we would, based on those areas that we've identified, like training, like reporting, like investigations, we would then develop operational procedures of who does what, when, and why. I think you there was, let's take for example, a current investigation, active investigation. Our focus,
of the focus of railways internationally is that you're not looking for the scapegoat, the guilty individual. You're looking for the failure of the process. And to find out what went wrong in the process to address that. My understanding from reading the occupational health and safety legislation is they ultimately look to see somebody that they can go to be prosecuted. And we don't want to go down the prosecution. And of course, the trick is to get the confidence within the operators and the staff and then Chris's the staff that we are not there to find if that driver made a mistake. If he did, we want to find out what went wrong in the process that allowed him to make a mistake. And that's if the European has a European standard on that, which we actually incorporated in our thinking to this end. And in fact, in the amendment to the standard I'm referring to, we call it a just system. And we picked that up from the Australians, says we need to make sure that what we're doing is fair and equitable both to the individual and to the operator and to us, because we have another job to do.
So, in short, what you're saying is you agree with the basis that these things in place, that you've draft regulations, which are more specific about these matters.
Actually, a standard, yes. It's a standard.
From standard, yes. Which are more specific about these matters. But, and there was a but in all of what you're saying, the but seems to be that if you are still awaiting the development of a working relationship with the Department of Labor. And obviously we would not agree that that's not a long thing, but I was a little concerned, I think where safety is concerned, I don't think we should much get tangled up in terms of our jurisdiction. Clearly, insofar as occupational health and safety impacts on rail safety, you don't need to instance an MOU and negotiations to happen or whatever.
Chair, if I respond, that's exactly what we recognize, and that's the amendment that we incorporate in the stance now. We will do it. We will make sure that it's done.
Hopefully with the collaboration of the Department of Labor, but if you don't get it back, the key thing we're asking is there anything in our legislation that's impeding you from doing it?
I think that one of the representations is that the size of the inspectorate. And the funding, and we also the contribution to all of that.
But there's nothing in the legislation.
We could decide to go to the British route and then make occupational health and safety and operational safety with the jurisdiction of the regulator. But that would mean that we now have to go and talk to the Department of Labour to take that jurisdiction away from there.
But we're not saying that. What we're saying is the test that Britain must be put in the test must be insofar as the test can exist within your jurisdiction. And is any business for government should this be
secure? Why can't it be? I mean, the premise is going to be based on some criteria of which those standards are two more times. And we don't issue a permit. I mean, unless there are certain things in place, that they have been issued devices to prevent hearing loss, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That the cab is adequately sealed, that it's got some fresh air, or some air conditioning. I'm giving examples of what should be entrenched as a condition, as opposed to just leaving it there to meet the I really am concerned that we should be very.
Most of the accidents are by human error. And if we go further, majority of them are due to fatigue. Trains are still working with 200 hours overtime. It's unacceptable. And like Stuart has said, surely in the permit, compliance with the VGA should be amazing. I mean, if the finding of the RSR is that it was a human error, it was due to fatigue, not sufficient rest, long hours and those kind of things, surely the RSR should be entitled to take the necessary steps. And that could be included in the permit.
I'd attend the need for those standards, whatever, if you are in the process of issuing the permit. liberal arts is when the president is an issue and those standards fall apart, what happens? If the president is an issue and then maybe the president is going to go for 3 years or 5 years, I don't know. And then within the third of the period, and then certain things crop up. Because what this presentation has comes out, I think on page 2 at the bottom, is to say that the RSR to have real power to deal with unsafe conditions. And these unsafe conditions may just emerge after an attempt has been here. And then what happens? That was my little understanding that we need to really look at the power that the RSR is given to be able to deal with this particular unsafe condition as and when they arrive. Unlike just to watch and wait to go to the power.
Would you like to concentrate on that
all things in life, you have a system that says this is the way you're going to operate. And for failure, Chris used the word human failure, for whatever reason, you can have technical failures in the world, that's the reality of the world we live in. The question is, what do we do about those failures? We are empowered, in terms of the current legislation, to be now, for any unsafe situation or behavior as we're proposing it, to take action. The point of machine to stop the service if it got to that. Maybe we haven't implemented all the things we could have done. And without trying to make excuses, we are with only half a dozen inspectors, you cannot get everything that needs to be done, and we recognize that. And I'm hearing very clearly what everyone is saying, that we must not use any excuse for not doing what the Act currently allows us to do because of bureaucratic issues. We should now step in and in whatever way we need to step in. And I think that message will get home from Evie and myself back to regulator. That's what the refinement of this thinking.
one is not enough today, maybe we will agree with one. This is just one and not the same. Which means that we have then got this for time. Of the transport, the rail situation, all the rail situations, it's just how we can make it up. So this allows getting up. But we can't extend on any of the things we want to do.
I'm just saying we can just make reference to it where we have it there to the main act, which, you know, is part of the Justice Act. I can't remember what it's all about, but, you know.
Like law complaint that has been taken place into that and didn't direct the regulator. Not an issue. Maybe the regulator might take that as a passport to check exactly what was in that person's case alongside with the legal case limit and so forth.
Okay,
is page one, because this is just the cover page. Number two, the final transfer rate. There was some kind of shocking issue that ministers discovered. And after that, there were maybe some follow-up that was supposed to be made. But it's like those things have not been done. So I'm saying the regulator must also check as a passport why nothing has not been done for such a compliance. Why are they not compliant? But subsequently, the question on the issue of the capacity, it was not yet answered. I understand that we are dealing with legislation, but there are glaring problems in the railway system. But this is an operational issue. And some of these things, it seems like 200 overtime hours that have been worked by an individual, then surely there's a problem. What is the problem around financing of posts? It's because also in your page 3, in a page 3 document, it talks about there's no sufficient management, workers team ongoing issues, and so on, numbers of training, signing, and all those things. What are the real problems? Whether they have a problem on the finances, they don't have finance or their own that are not eventually being funded. What are these real problems? Before we can deal with this real issue. Because even if we can deal with this legislation, if there is no capacity, we can come up with legislation, but if there is no capacity to implement, then the crisis.
The situation is actually here that the company is between two fires. You know, the crocodile on the one side and the lion on the other side. You've got to eat the Employment Equity Act to comply with, where you do have standard systems that have been wiped for 25 years, but they cannot revert to train drivers, promoted to train drivers, because of the Employment Equity Act. And that's why the feeling is outside there that, you know, you've got to comply with employment equity, but on the other hand, are you justifying your safety environment? And that's the issue. I've got sympathy with the company, but also on the safety side, it's a predicament for us. Then on a noise level situation, because we at that time, the Honourable Minister, when he came out, he was over eager and excited, and we started off with a big bang, translate newspapers and everything, and in our own boardroom, he gave instructions to the then CEO, by December, he's got to comply with the act. We still ask him, what will happen if the company do not comply? Then he said to the CEO, CEO don't lie to ministers. Then they get fired. But we 4 years later, and although we have involved the minister today, the provincial safety structures had a meeting with freight rail and all that, but it's embarrassing, like I previously said. You
know, you involve the minister on the highest level possible, and 4 years later, you haven't resolved the problem. And that's why it's easy for us as a union to go to the Department of Labor, you know, non-compliance with the BCA, non-compliance with the different Labor Relations Act, and, but sorry, the results we get from the Department of Labor is not wonderful.
Then there's the capacity question, which I think was addressed more from the rail safety regulator.
Yeah, because we never involved the rail safety regulator because we believed it's the responsibility of the Department of Labor. The never, no state ever, we referred the issue to that RSI.
But having said that, we've recognized on our own back that, in fact, as you've indicated, we will write a clause in the Act bringing in the impact of occupational health and safety on operational safety. A simple clause that will now, it will give us leverage on the operator in those areas that have an impact on operational safety. The question of capacity, as the member indicated, I think we've tried to indicate that with the budgetary constraints that have been imposed upon us, we haven't managed to do all the things that we proposed and desired to do and are required to do.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Can I make follow-up? Chair, the question around this, I think it's appropriate. We know that mineral and energy, they've got their own inspector, who is as well as a real council. Department of Trade, but they compared to standards in terms of safety regulations. I just want to check these inspectors, whether are the inspectors from Labor Department or are the inspectors from the regulator? And if they are inspectors from the regulator, what is the problem? Whether they are less in number, there is a problem around their capacity. What is the problem exactly? I cannot understand what is the problem. It is an inspector from the regulator. I cannot understand what is the problem. How many inspectors have you got? Can you tell us what you're asking?
Half a dozen, can you remember? Six inspectors?
Yes.
You need for many.
How many do you need? We've made a proposal and a related submission, and I haven't got the numbers on it. I think 18 is the number I have in my head. The inspector is what we're looking for. We recently transferred two of them to the Cape, they're down here now, so we've been focused on the Saldana, the Western Cape, and up the Eastern Cape. So we have a long distance to study. But the rest of them are in our office in Johannesburg.
Let's
try to
keep things keep them all together, but also focus on what we have to do, but at the same time not forget all the things. So the issues around transmit freight rail and the transmission policies, and if you've got a particular concern about that, find it legitimate and so on, it's the basis of it. But not really our business today, and not our business at all. That we have to do with to engage corporate policy in the transit sector. That's all on the public end of life and how we can solve it. Okay. But nonetheless, it's important to ask what if there's a sense of policy. Okay. Secondly, we're not going to get tangled up with issues perfectly in order to raise the Minister of Labour or any other minister is not doing their work across the system. I have no problem with that. That's not our business today, but thank you for raising that. Capacity issues are also not issues we can write into the legislation, but when we take into account the amendment, certainly what we must say, and see, that our impression is that what is already legislated for that in 2000.
potentially what we're doing. We're listening to each other. Other practical things will happen. That's in the rail safety regulator itself. We will raise that the fundamentally the one core thing that we have, or we look deeper than we can, in the wording that we have here, just make more firmly and clearly the interface between them, and therefore empower, the need empowering the rail safety regulator to understand that those things.
Thinking about that, would it be impossible to say the minimum of inspectors should be X amount? Would it be just... Packaging, not on
whether the legislation is good enough for us or for someone else, but we're probably to monitor. Am I right or wrong? Saying, well, we're doing it for active because we're where we pick up a non-compliant.
Well, I read that for you because you might have a box of chemicals got it.
Yeah.
And they didn't compliantly put an arrow to say this way up, and they go and load them as an activity into a carriage and this stuff leaks out all along the way.
That's why
I'm
agreeing with non-compliant. Incident triggering your ability to go out of the railway environment.
So therefore it must be
or non-compliant. They say, now you've got something.
Yeah.
Now, actually, the
like it, they weren't very happy with this stuff. They have the
serious infection. Now, because if you have mandate expansion, then you end up by not doing what you have to do. You start to not have. We don't want them to have a friendly relationship or otherwise. But if there is an issue, for me that's the key, but if there is volume of science on the rail or an incident, then I would like to see the sensor having the public sensor to track it back.
Prevent.
But only in those cases. Because we're dealing with some problem that is just on the rail in my something that may be a bit somewhere in some satellite flight. I would like it to be triggered by some kind of non-compliance with what is required or natural. I think the joke is what purpose I may propose. I think it's right in respect of we should not any other activity in the beginning of it. But if I may suggest that any such, I'll only read the whole thing, I would like to suggest, in addition to the 1,001.3, a railway inspector may, in the event of a railway occurrence or non-compliance with this act, affecting the safe transportation of dangerous goods by rail, audit, inspect, or investigate such occurrence or non-compliance and other activity. Now, I'll tell you now, despite the fact, the other activity in this context for me, you have an incident now, and there's something that comes back, happens before, which may be packaging or something. Yeah. I'm kind of, if we talk about all any other activity, we have a railway occurrence or non-compliance. Strike out for any other activity. That's too wild. But you may then investigate distinct from triggered by the key thing is what triggers non-compliance in the rail system or next. Then you can investigate. Now, I'm happy with what
could I just mention an example many years ago, a petrol train that was not fully loaded, and on the first very steep down gradient in North Cape, this train ran away and overturned. Where would that be covered now? Couldn't that be included in other activities? Because the same way that the petrol train was not fully loaded, all the tanks were just 3/4. And when it went down the downgrade, the petrol started moving, and that caused the train to run away and overturn in the Kai bridge. Now, could that not be included in other activities?
My response to Chris, if I may, Chair, is that it's an occurrence. And first of all, now we can go and investigate what happened to provide if it was incorrectly loaded, and whatever it is would be what you go and research to see what contributed to that occurrence, which was a derailment. But it was triggered by the derailment. And so you go back and see why did they not fill the tank up, or why did they not do whatever they didn't do.
And then you would now require the
correspondence.
It might involve you having to go into that. In addition to the past compensated in subsections 1, 3, a railway safety inspector may, in the event of any railway occurrence or non-compliance with this act, affecting the safety of transportation, the pension